Welcome back to episode 29 of the Run Culture podcast, and this one is an absolute gem. Today I had the privilege to talk to Dr. Carl Woods, a scientist and researcher at Victoria University in Melbourne, who enjoys exploring the concepts of learning, knowing, and skill from an ecological and anthropological lens in sport. The best thing about his articles, or if you've ever heard him on a podcast, is he is very philosophical and a great thinker, and a lot of his concepts extend to just how we should live. This episode, I think, is pertinent for so many patients that I see, and just so much many of us that live in a society that prioritizes productivity, extraction, speed, and efficiency. We talk about, and this is what Carl says at one point in the episode, that certain non-Western societies don't use the adjectives efficient, rapid, or fast as words to describe expert performance. They actually use words like cautious, slow, attentiveness, and responsiveness. These slower adjectives are used to describe what it means to be an expert hunter. They understand the idea of uncertainty. They take time to attend to the rich contextual ebbs and flows of information in front of them, and they patiently wait for the right moment to act. We further discuss in this episode that currently, the world as we see it, with all the social media, we currently live in an information age. There's a post about this, a post about that. There's an excess of secondhand information everywhere. We have a test for this, a test for that, a strategy for this, and all this tech spitting out all kinds of data. Universities teach courses in siloed and reduced methods and reward an encyclopedic-like recall of information as expertise. Yes, secondhand information can be useful, but I'm also seeing a lot of unembodied, disconnected, confused, and disempowered runners as a result. We go on to talk about the importance of inhabitant knowledge, as I specified before, when Carl spoke of non-Western societies and how they value hunters. Inhabitant knowledge is knowledge gained through exposure and primary experience. This can't simply be replaced by secondhand information, e.g. what a textbook, test, or Instagram post says. Embracing uncertainty and the wisdom of not knowing. We also talk about this, and we also talk about slowing down and attending to the environment around you, being a wayfinder, as Carl states it. And we also talk about what defines mastery and a skilled performer or an expert. And this is sort of what I alluded to before. With the hunter example, so the humility to say, I don't know, or I am unsure, being open, having lots of exposure to a certain environment and context, to resonate with their surrounds, to look, feel, hear, and smell better, to know what to pay attention to, what to stretch towards, and when to wait and be patient. These are some fantastic concepts that just need to be heard for time and time again because of the society we live in. I see people, like I said, unembodied, disconnected, confused, and disempowered. So I think this discussion with Carl really speaks truth to a lot of that, and I hope you find it useful in one way or another and get some kind of thread of importance from it that reverberates with you and helps you along your way to not just be a better runner, or but be a more complete and balanced human, and to be a happy human. So I hope you enjoy this show, and thanks Dr. Carl Woods for jumping on. Here it is, without further ado, Dr. Carl Woods. Thanks for jumping on the chat with me. I've really got a lot out of listening to your podcasts and reading a lot of your papers. Like, it's made me like sit down and read your papers, and I really think you're onto something with that inhabitant knowledge. I'm a physiotherapist, and I've been a physio now for probably 13 years, and Yeah, and then just with the social media age and all the information out there, you just see so many people just unsure of what to do and just copying things and not sure whether that applies to them and just so uncertain. And so it's been really, I've learned a lot from it, and it's helped me actually as a physio heap, because it actually goes through my mind each day. I'm like, oh, am I just over instructing here and over coaching and telling them what to do, or should I actually stand back and listen more and actually get a bit more of a feel for where they're at? And it's been great.
That's absolutely wonderful to hear. I one of the big joys I have is hearing how these ideas resonate in different areas. I never set out to write for a particular audience. I write for a particular audience of me, you know, like I write for interest for me, and it's just an added bonus that people like yourself take interest in these things because they matter so much to me. But you're absolutely right in this age of I call it like an economy of secondhand information, where it's everywhere. You know, we're replete. We almost think, we almost are at risk of thinking knowledgeability is being able to recite facts and collect data and analyze that data. Whereas from my worldview, I guess knowledgeability isn't firstly a thing that we can ever acquire. But the real point of it all is that we're always knowing better, and to know better, we have to perceptually engage with our surrounds. We have to listen, we have to feel, we have to smell, taste, see things for ourselves. So it's not secondary information, it's primary information. And that primary information, or what you said then, that inhabitant knowledge, that's the real stuff that regulates our behavior. So someone might come into your clinic, for example, and you can just tell that they're walking a bit odd, right? Something just feels a bit different in how they're walking. That attunement that you have to that information isn't something that I think you can pick up in a textbook, or isn't something even that you as an experienced physiotherapist could tell an inexperienced physiotherapist. What we need to do is encourage people to be exposed to those opportunities, and they can learn to attend to them, those things directly where they are for themselves. My partner, Chloe, she manages the Neuromoves Spinal Cord Injury Australia Clinic in Footscray, and we have this discussion regularly. She has students come in on their placement experience, on their placement experiences and opportunities, and their first thing they do is they look at patients that's the first thing. They look at them as patients or clients through a textbook lens. They go, oh, they're presenting with this condition. So on page X of that textbook, they said I needed to do this, right? The first thing Chloe almost works towards is, look, that's important to a degree. That secondary information can be of use. If I've never cooked a lasagna before, a recipe is important, right? But the textbook, the recipe, the formalized course that we've gone through doesn't help us immediately immediately interact with that particular person. Not a client, they're a person. And why it doesn't is because that person lives a very storied life. They have all of these things that go on, which we can't glean from a textbook, that we learn by spending time with them. We go, oh, this person presents with CP, for example, so I should do X, Y, and Z. Well, actually, no, that doesn't work in this particular case, because this person lives in this particular way, in this particular setting. They like to do these particular things. They have a real distaste for this, or they have a real fear of that. So that inhabitant knowledge is what regulates our behavior and how we correspond and interact with people. So you're absolutely on the money. It's this age old, this economy of secondhand information, I think, has gone a bit too far at some point we need to bring it back to this real sentient appreciation of how we come to know things.
Yeah, no, it's that was, yeah, and you articulate it really well. I've got a boy I coach who's just finished exercise science at Deakin Uni, and he's a real great kid and really passionate about what he does. But he hasn't had the practical knowledge until he's had a bit of an exposure at a gym the last 6 months, and he's learned just so much. And often, like, he's great to talk to because he'd often keep me on my toes in terms of the latest research and what the textbooks are saying. But then, like, often he would stubbornly say, no, it's this way because the textbook says it's this way.
Yep.
And then I could just see a few light bulbs go off in the last 6 months since he's had this placement, because it's exactly what you said. He was on the ground level with the patient, realizing that they weren't buying into some of the concepts that he'd learned at uni, and he had to really work at developing those communication skills, buy-in, working where the patient was at, learning the patient's life story and how they're different than the next person, and somehow getting them to apply some of the concepts that he had learned, but then also, like, it was more on that ground level. So it was awesome to see him actually start to go, oh, hang on, there's a little bit more to it. I don't know everything. I'm always learning.
Yeah, I think that's some of the most experienced practitioners that I've ever worked with almost have this like humility and this wisdom to think there is no way that I can know everything there is to know about X, Y, or Z. I like to speak in through things that matter to me and life experiences and these types of things. And I often think, I've never undertaken a course or read a book or had a test on what I know about my partner, Chloe. Never had any formalized training about her. But I know her better than anything else in the world. How do I know her better? And what would that actually mean? What does that mean, knowing better, then, if I've never undertaken any formalized courses or been assessed about her? Well, knowing her better first is about learning to resonate with her in ways that are really intimate and sensitive. So I can hear in her voice that something's not quite right. I can see in her demeanor that something's slightly off. On the flip side, I can hear in her voice that she's really excited or eager to say something, or I can see in how she's moving that she's feeling really good, or whatever it might subsequently be. All of this rich stuff is how I come to know her better, and I come to know her better by spending time with her, by investing the time to learn to resonate with these things and pick up these things about her, which she inadvertently would do the same with me. But there's no textbook about how subsequently to do that. They come to matter, these people and these things come to matter to us because we spend a lot of time in the particular context with them. Now, again, that's not to completely discredit formalized training and courses and these types of things. Absolutely not. My thought with those kinds of things is that they should almost encourage the ongoing journey of knowing better. It shouldn't be a start and end. I shouldn't go, well, I've done a four-year undergraduate course. I've done a one-year placement. I'm now I've got a master in sports physiotherapy. That's all I need to know. Sweet. I don't need to know anything more. I should be able to step foot in a clinic, and any patient that presents to me, I should be able to find somewhere in my training that I've been exposed to that, draw on that, and, you know, follow it to a T about how to interact with that person, as anyone would know, listening or you yourself. That's not how it works. That's absolutely not how it works. It's not a matter of doing a course and you're done. That's the start. That just starts the process, and then you're on this ongoing journey of continually knowing better. Me, for example, I've done an undergraduate, an honours degree, a PhD, postdocs. I've worked in various places. And at no point ever on this, you know, now nearly 15-year journey, have I thought, that's it. I've reached the point. I don't need to know anything else, because I've known all there is to know about skill acquisition and movement science and human movement and ecological dynamics. I don't need to know anything more. I've figured it all out. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Every day something presents something new, a new discussion can be had. You can start to attend to different features because you're always knowing better. You're always coming to hear things slightly differently. You're always coming to see things slightly differently, have conversations in slightly different ways. And if we stay open and responsive to those things, we can really start, I think, to know the world a little better than before, things that interest us at least, a little better than before.
Oh, fantastic. I think, like, speaking of that, like, I do a bit of online coaching, but then also I coach a group in person, and I find this is running coaching. I find coaching the athletes in person so much easier, because I see them three times a week, and there's these little aspects that you pick up, like they're not talking in the warm-up, they're lagging behind, yep. These unspoken things that you just pick up, and you don't see them online. You just see their Strava GPS run and maybe a comment or two, but that's dependent if that they're being honest or not. But yeah, it's so much easier to feel like confident that you're picking up the right signals when you're coaching in person, I find. And also on that lasagna making example, I wanted to just raise my wife's nonna, Vilma, makes such a good lasagna, and several years ago, she had a lasagna making contest with Jess's dad, and the whole family was blinded to who made which lasagna, and Nonna won 9-1. And she's probably made lasagna for 70 odd years and just honed her craft. We asked for the recipe after she won that contest, and we can't make it the same. She just must be able to pick up on, yeah, certain cues and signals that she's just experienced over time that are important, and she knows what to, yeah, it's these fine details that you can't find in a cooking book.
That's a brilliant example. I love to hear that, because that's exactly it. You know, she could write the recipe word for word down to the T, you know, like she almost to the second of how long you need to let things simmer for. But no recipe can help you experience what something smells like or looks like or sounds like. All of those things you need to experience yourself. Now, the other kicker with this too is that all of that inhabitant knowledge is deeply entangled in the place that she does the cooking, right? So she would be intimately familiar with her kitchen, with the oven, with the stove, with the amount of gas you need, with the height of the flame, with the pots and the pans and where everything's located. So even if you were to take, this is, again, this is the important part of contextualizing this inhabitant knowledge. We like to think that, oh, well, I can just scribble all this stuff down and I'll be able to recite this. I'll be able to make this lasagna in any kitchen in the world. That's absolutely not how it goes. You know, like a example more familiar to me is Chloe. Her father is an organic cane farmer in North Queensland. Has lived on this property for all his life. He's 52, 53. He's lived there for that period of time. And he is exceptionally skilled at picking up things that other people can't, in terms of, it feels like it's going to rain on Tuesday. I'm like, mate, it's Saturday. How have you picked that up? He's like, oh, I can smell the moisture coming off the ocean, which is, you know, 30 kilometers in that direction. I'm like, geez, all right. What did you pick up? And then slowly you can start to pick up these things and attend to these things. But, you know, I've known Chloe for 8 years. I've known him for that period of time. And no way am I ever at a point, neither is Chloe, who's obviously lived a lot of her life, they're at a point similar to him, but we start to attend to different features. Now, if we were to take him and put him on a farm down here in Melbourne and say, recreate the farm up there down here, well, he's not going to be able to do it, right? Yeah, of course, he's a skilled farmer, but that skilled farming is embedded and entangled in that land, in that climate, in that place that skill has been grown and that knowledge of his surrounds has been forged. And so that's a misconception and this belief in educational systems that knowledge is universal and abstract. So we do an undergraduate course on hamstring injuries, for argument's sake, right? So you think, oh, yeah, okay, so I take this knowledge, this secondhand knowledge that's been transmitted to me by, you know, a lecturer at university. My job as a physiotherapist is then to take that knowledge and apply it in any hamstring injury I ever encounter again. As any physio listening would attest, I'm sure, that's not how it goes. Every hamstring presents something different. Why? Because every person is different. Every context is different. Their life is unfolding in different ways. You yourself, as a practitioner, are different from when you did that undergraduate course. Your interactions have changed. The context that you work in has changed. All of these things go on, which means that knowledge isn't abstract, it isn't universal, it's deeply situated, it's deeply embedded in the context that we work within. And that context isn't just physical, it's not just about the physio bed that you use or the strapping tape that you use, or even you, the person, your features, or the person you're working with. It's not just those physical things. It also includes the socio-cultural things that are entangled in the people and in the places that you work. You might work with a person, let's just say for argument's sake, for the case of hypothesis, you have two people and they present with supposedly exactly the same condition, right, that you're working with. But one has been brought up in an environment that, you know, it's they're cut from a different generational cloth. Stiff upper lip, things don't hurt, you just carry on, you just keep going. And then you have the other person who is the complete opposite to that. So they're, where I'm getting at is perhaps their pain thresholds are different despite the fact that the condition on paper is the same. That socio-cultural fact of where they've been grown up, clearly then shapes how you as the clinician, the practitioner, correspond with them and interact with them and set up your plans and work with them and get them back to some level of health. I know that personally from my perspective. I love running. I do a lot of running and I enjoy the notion of pushing through discomfort, right? As most distance runners have this weird enjoyment for it. comparatively, Chloe, my partner, hates it, yeah. Right? So the way she runs is completely different to the way I run. The programming and all of these things is completely different for no other reason other than our pain tolerance and our pain enjoyment and our pain threshold. So when I sustain some particular type of injury, I'm less inclined to act upon it than perhaps she might. Now, that doesn't mean one of us is right or tough or wrong or not. It just means that we're different. We approach things differently. So our rehabilitation, our recovery, our approach to training is clearly going to need to be very nuanced to our needs, which ties back to this notion that there is no abstract knowledge for application in any context. Absolutely not. Our knowledge of the world is very much embedded in the particular places that we spend our time, or what we often say in our work, you know, our knowledge of the world is forged in dwelling, in spending time in particular contexts, which then by default means that an expert, in inverted commas, I don't love that term at all, but an expert isn't someone that knows more than other people. Like you as a practitioner with this rich experience in your particular context, it doesn't make you better, I guess. It doesn't make you more knowledgeable than someone else because you've undertaken all these courses. It just means that you've spent longer in that particular place. You're more attentive to things than other people. In the same way that your partner's Nonna, she's more attentive to the lasagna because she spent longer in that particular context than someone else. But that other person might be more attentive to something else because they spent longer in that particular context. So again, this notion of expertise then becomes incredibly relative to the places that we spend our time and the things that we end up doing in those places that we invest our time within.
Yeah, that's fantastic. When I prepared for this podcast, I wrote like quite a few questions, but then I'd also came across quite a few of your articles where they said, there was this canoe coach that said that one of their athletes at the Olympics regarded their preparation, they were prepared but not planned. And I sort of took that concept to try to prepare for this podcast, but it was really hard because I wanted to feel certain that I knew what I was doing and what I was going to ask and that I didn't get stumped or stuck and I made it worthwhile. Why do we struggle to cope so much with uncertainty as humans? Like why is that? Because I've read some of your stuff where, and I agree, like that's where the magic is, like the uncertainty, because that's where you're going to be more likely to sort of embrace your current context and environment and your individualness and uniqueness rather than have sort of this preconceived like notion of how to approach something and you're going to, you know, emergent things are going to come out of that. Why do we struggle with uncertainty?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And for record, I think you're doing a great job. You know, you're asking great questions and it's a great discussion. That's what it really comes. So I often think life is just an ongoing conversation. It's an ongoing correspondence. It's not question and answer. It's just ongoing sharing and blending together of experiences. But this notion of uncertainty and almost being scared of it is fascinating. I think it's really complex in that there's a lot of entangled parts of why we claim for certainty. And one of them, I think, is that we idolize experts as people almost like encyclopedias. You ask them and they just regurgitate it back, you know, like, oh, what is this? Bang. What is that? Bang. Why does this happen? Bang. And you're like, wow, that person's pretty certain. They know everything. Like, geez. And we almost put them on a pedestal. And we go, that's what intelligence is. Intelligence is being able to recite and regurgitate information. Why that's the case? We set it up in schools, right? And universities, I, coming through that system, have done exactly the same. A test's coming up. What do? Well, you just recite what you need to recite. You ask what's going to be in the test and you remember that as best you can. And then when the exam comes around, you try to regurgitate that information. I have no long-term sustained knowledge of those things. I've just been able to recite that information because that supposedly is what intelligence is in society that we live. Fascinatingly, though, in non-Western societies, right, in these non-overly productive, efficient, fast-paced societies, what various ethnographic inquiries have shown is certain non-Western societies don't use the adjectives of efficient and rapid and fast as words to describe expert performance. They actually use words like cautious and slow and attentiveness and responsiveness, these like slower adjectives to describe what it means to be an expert hunter or an expert trapper or an expert canoe maker or these types of things. And that what they appreciate, or I think in what is embroiled in that appreciation, is that there is never no no certainty. We can't ever be certain about things, right? And that certainty is entangled in this notion of knowing more. The more I know, the more certain I become. Actually, I think what you find with most experienced practitioners in any domain, whether that be in physiotherapy, canoe coaching, education, whatever that might be, the more experienced practitioners, at least that I've worked with, football coaches particularly, are the ones that are almost really uncertain. Why, and they asked, you know, why did that happen? Or I'm not really sure. It could have been because of this, or it could have been because of that. Now, that doesn't mean that they don't know anything. It's perhaps that they know that there are lots of things that could have gone on. So let's use that as a thread to probe a little bit more, to inquire a little bit more into. So there's this fear of uncertainty, I think, comes from this belief that expertise is encyclopedic, is regurgitating information. Whereas expertise really, I think, is just knowing where to start your search and then being really embodied in your search, really listening, really hearing. You, for example, might work with a patient and you just can't figure out why they're presenting in this particular way, right? You're like, geez, I'm an expert physiotherapist. I've worked with this for 13 years. Yeah. I should know this. Yeah. Why don't I know this? You know, like, this is really frustrating. You just need to wait on that information. Somewhere along the line, it will pop out. Now, embracing that humility encourages what we refer to as response ability. So opening yourself to response for another and from another. So if you're forever looking at a patient as a textbook and going, they're not this, next thing, not this, next thing, not this, next thing, you may have missed the most important bit of information that presented from day one right in front of you. They have a young child who has been sick for the last few weeks that always wants to be picked up for something as simple as that. And that notion of always picking them up has loaded a particular region of their body, which has led to this, which has led to this. And all of a sudden it cascades into all of these other things. But if you're not paying attention to those things because you're certain it's something else, you're more inclined to miss that real rich information that could present. So this has led us to kind of explore this word attention. What does it mean then to pay attention to things if we're to embrace uncertainty, right? And almost challenge ourselves to follow what we refer to as like an epistemology of not knowing. Of epistemology is how we classify knowledge. Yeah. And we're almost going, well, there is no such thing, right? So the epistemology of not knowing, what does it mean to pay attention to things? And really fascinatingly, what we found is like there's two sides to attention. One side is this first side of expertise. And this the etymology of this word version of attention is ad tendere, which means to stretch toward, right? So if I'm on a trail run, for example, I have been so wound up, swept up in the joy of being on the trail, that I followed kind of my nose of things that have been interesting for me. And all of a sudden I go, shit, I'm lost. Like, I don't know where I am anymore. That at that moment of uncertainty, I'm looking for things to stretch toward, the sound of a distant car, maybe another voice, or the direction of the sun to know where I've been running. I'm stretching toward this information, quite literally, like really stretching out towards it. That's one side, right? So in a world of certainty, we're always stretching towards things that are there, that we think are there. But the other side of attention, the other version of it, this other side of the coin, is an etymology of attendre in French, which basically means to wait on, right? So in a world of things that are always on their way to somewhere else, in this uncertain world, things are always emerging. They're always showing themselves and decaying and appearing and disappearing. And these things are always ebbing and flowing, as I like to say. So if you pay attention to things, you have to stretch towards things that are there, but also wait on things that emerge. This patience, this forbearance, this carefulness. And this is the interpretation of expertise in non-Western society, this waiting on things, this carefulness, this caution, because you know something could emerge that is really vital towards, you know, you figuring your way out. So I'm on a trail run, can't hear anything. I can't see anything that's going to help me on my way. So what am I going to do? I might move a little bit further and see if something else opens up, or I might wait a little bit longer and just see if I can hear something. Great example is, you know, when hunters in the circumpolar region are caught in a blizzard, a complete whiteout. There is nothing for them to stretch toward. So they bunker down and they wait for the blizzard to clear and then stretch toward snow formations that have changed shape in the wind, or various things that they're able to then subsequently stretch toward. So we have this like certainty, uncertainty, these two sides of attention. And I think if we're too hard to view or too hard to claim for expertise and too hard to claim for certainty, we almost view then mastery and expertise as imposing things onto a passive world. Whereas real expertise, in my opinion, and through the various research we've done and the ethnographic inquiries that we've undertaken, the real expert performers actually have it the other way around. It's not this certainty that leads and uncertainty that ensues. It's actually this uncertainty that leads, this submission to the world on the go, and then this masterful search, this masterful desire to follow up with it, right? So mastery doesn't lead, it's submission that leads, and mastery follows. So if I'm pushing my boat out into Port Phillip, into the bay just here, if I'm pushing it out, the masterful sailor isn't the one that sticks up the sail and tries to impose the sail onto the wind. The masterful sailor is the one that waits for the right wind, maximizes that opportunity when it's there, gets the sail up and tacks accordingly, moves the boat accordingly. And I'd imagine in your area, the masterful practitioner, the masterful physiotherapist, is the one that attends openly and responsively to what's presented, and then masterfully picks up the scent, picks up the trace, and follows along. That's why I don't, in my current academic post, I'm a research only academic. I don't teach, but I often think how different undergraduate degrees would be in these types of areas, in all types of areas, but especially in these types of allied health professions, if we started to view education like we're trying to train really good hunters. Right, we're trying to train really good, not passive recipients of knowledge that regurgitate that information, not these experts that profess their expertise onto the world, but we're actually trying to train hunters. And really good hunters, as I said before, they have this submission leads and mastery follows. So they wait on things, and when those things emerge, they act on them. And the ancient Greeks had a word for that. It was called kairos, which meant acting at that right moment. So your partner's nonna, for example, in making the lasagna, she would just know that right moment when to add maybe a little bit of spice or a little bit of herb, just at that right time. If you're a bit early, it mightn't make the dishes nice. If you're a bit late, you may have missed the opportunity. But just at that right time, she adds that particular spice. And in your case, it might be just at that right time hearing someone say, oh, actually, you mentioned that your child's a bit unwell. Can you talk me through that a little bit more? And then you realize, oh, there's all these other cascading things which have led on to why they're presenting in this untextbook-like way. But it's all about this remaining humble enough to be uncertain, to hang on to this epistemology of not knowing, because there's a wonderful sentiment in this book called At the Lock of the Green Corrie, which in that paper you brought up with this canoe coach, it's with Craig Morris. It's called On the Wisdom of Not Knowing, Reflections of an Olympic Canoe Slalom Coach. We start the paper with an excerpt from this book, and this person talks about their friend who actively decides to not know about the birds that draw his curiosity. He thought by labelling the birds as this species, it's going to straight away cloud his perception of them. He's going to look at the bird as this particular bird who feeds in this particular way, who mates at this particular time of the season, who nests in that particular tree. So he's going to look at the bird as this species. instead of coming to know the bird as a really rich, dynamic form of life, which does all of these diverse things based upon all of these things that it attends to. So he gets to know it at a much more intimate, personal level. He's not looking at a bird as a parrot who should be doing this. He's looking at a bird as a bird who is becoming a bird through all of these various activities that it undertakes. And to me, at least, that's always been really fascinating. I try hard not to label and categorize in a certain way and try hard to attend to things as they are and as they emerge or occur along the way.
Oh, yeah, that was, amazing to listen to, Carl. And, already, like, you've spoken so much gold. I think so many listeners will take so much from this. I think they really needed to hear this kind of point of view when it comes to trying to learn about themselves. There were so many threads just then that reverberated with me. Like, you pretty much just described my day as a physio. So often the last 5 minutes, you know, the patient says something, you're like, oh, hang on, I think that must be important, that might be important, or it's not till the third appointment where you're like, oh, I didn't realize this about this person. And it suddenly makes you understand the condition or the person just a little bit more and feel like you're heading a bit more in the right direction. In 2014 as well, I went to Kenya for 7 weeks and I tried to, I just wanted to know why the Kenyans were good runners. And so I went to I-10 and I trained with the Kenyans. And it's funny because I picked up a lot of things about, their culture and their diet, their way of living. And one thing was Kenyan time and they were just really slow at doing things. If they got stuck in a 2-hour traffic jam, which was often the case because their roads were, not the best. I remember being stuck in a bus and the two drivers of the neighboring buses were just legs crossed on the dashboard, hands behind the head and laughing and just telling stories to each other. And I just was like, if this was back home in Australia, everyone would be stressed and hands on their hips and looking at their watches. And they were so much slower paced. And I think that was a good thing because then they were able to sort of take in the moment and maybe better attuned to certain things that were important and not just rush their way through things. And that was something that I didn't feel like the culture, that was the biggest thing that I took away from that experience. I thought it was going to be some secret to how they trained there was a lot of things I took away, but that was one of the big things.
That's a brilliant observation. I think, you know, there's a wonderful book. I absolutely adore her writing. Her name's Rebecca Solnit. She wrote a book in 2001 called Wanderlust, A History of Walking. It's a fascinating book, but her prologue in that book particularly has stood out to me. I read it many years ago and it's kind of just hung around and it rears its head in various ways in some of our papers and these types of things. But there's a sentiment in her prologue where she says, you know, exploring the mind, the best way to explore the mind is to explore one's surrounds. And I think the mind works at about 3 miles per hour, which is about the speed of walking or a really slow jog, right? If we start to speed up, right, we miss things, we risk missing things. And that's really easy for me to say and to, you know, slow down and start to attend to things because you and I particularly, we live in a society, in a place that prioritizes productivity, you know, like, oh, you got rid of this meeting, so all of a sudden you can fill your time up with doing these other things, or this bit of technology is designed to make it more efficient for you to do these other things. So it's not about freeing up time for exploration and discovery and slowing down. It's about maximizing the time that we have by filling our days up with things. And I often find this really quite quite paradoxical, right? I work in an academic institution, and part of working in an academic institution is to engage in academic behavior. And part of that behavior is engaging in discussion and thought and provocation and writing and reading and spending time figuring things out together. At nowhere along my more recent journey is that stuff prioritized. Why? Because we have to be seen to be filling up our time. If I jumped on the phone and said to a colleague, nah, I can't meet with you at 10 o'clock till 12 o'clock today because I'm actually going for a walk and thinking through a particular challenge that I've spent the last 3 months on a project trying to figure out, they'll go, what the hell are you talking about? What do you mean? Like, that's not productive. That's not doing your job, right? That's the very problem, right? To me, that's the very problem, not just in my job, but in lots of other jobs. You know, it's all about fitting things in to become more productive. We often think, you know, an expert or a really important person is someone that's super busy. You know, like, oh, wow, that person, I have to book a meeting with them like 3 months in advance. They're so backed up. They must be like super important. That's crap, I think. Like, that's a cop out, you know? And if you're that busy, well, where's the enjoyment in the search for things, the discovery for things? Where are you coming to know better? All you're doing is potentially just reciting and regurgitating the same old stuff that you've done, and you're conforming to a system of productivity, which is all about efficiency and speed and transmission. Your example of spending time in Kenya, it's the priority of things that matter. You know, it's you know, we often think driving home from work in Melbourne, you're stuck in traffic. You're like, I just want to get home. Why do you want to get home? You're in a rush to get home to do nothing. You know, or maybe you're in a rush to get home to sit on the couch or to do this. Maybe there needs to be more of this appreciation of slowing down to pay attention to things. There's a wonderful example I was recently exposed to of this. A friend of mine in the UK, she works with coaches that explores these various ideas. And one of she's a long-term mountaineer, rescuer, guide, climber. One of her close friends many years ago had a terrible climbing accident in Tasmania, in the western region of Tasmania. They were climbing a pillar just offshore, a vertical pillar just offshore, and a massive boulder fell, hit this person, and they sustained significant life-changing injuries as a result of it. Terribly tragic, lots of things that have had to change in this person's life over a prolonged period of time. But in a recent discussion with him, talking through these things, something quite profound was said. You know, it was in a way, now don't misperceive this, in a way the incident had presented him with a gift, and that gift was that incident had forced him to slow down by default. His action capabilities significantly changed following this incident. So now when he goes fortunately he can still walk, so now when he goes for a walk in various areas, because this his action capabilities have significantly changed, he started to pay attention to things which he have otherwise would have walked straight past. So he's getting much more enjoyment in looking at how the leaves might change at the various times of the year, or how a bird may inhabit a nest, a particular tree in his garden, which these things previously would have meant nothing to him, but they're much more enriching to his life now, because by default he's had to slow down to these things. And the lesson he's taken from this, and the lesson he tries to advocate for others, is to try to find joy in the most subtle of things that we experience day in, day out. You know, such is the point of that when I might go for a walk to the local coffee shop on a weekend. I try to make a concerted effort to look up, increase my eye line from the ground in front of me, or not even wear sunglasses to mediate my interaction with the surrounds, to try to attend to the goings on of things as they are, to try to pay attention to a new bird that you mightn't have heard that noise in the sub. to then going even more specific to try to pay attention to weather formations or the swell of the waves before you go into the water, trying to attend to the unfolding going on of things. By default, that encourages you to slow down. That encourages you to kind of submit before exerting that mastery. You then take that type of gifting logic into your everyday practice, and all of a sudden I start, read a book, not to try to extract hard facts, which I can stick into a paper, which I have a timeline to get done. I read the book for the sheer enjoyment of reading, of discovering things as I go, and then drawing on those things if I need to or when I need to. And it becomes less about trying to productify my time through speed and becoming more efficient. And it becomes more about attending and enjoying and following things that are of genuine interest to you, because you become more response able to those things. And maybe that's what your example speaks to. Maybe this sociocultural constraint, which shapes their behavior to be on Kenyan time, or I've got some friends from the Solomon Islands, and they talk about it as island time.
Yeah.
It opens up opportunities which we would otherwise walk straight past or not bother attending to, because the sociocultural constraints acting upon us. So subtle things. I think some subtle changes can have some quite drastic implications in lots of parts of our lives. Now, that's clearly, again, not to be misheard as me all of a sudden saying, oh, well, we need to all go out and start to stare at leaves and start to clouds. The point is bigger. The point is that maybe we need to stop looking at trying to fill up our time to reach points and destinations and being overly productive. And we need to start to appreciate the joy in, as we are now, the joy in uncertain conversations, because the uncertainty that you may have had coming into this conversation has straight away encouraged you to be more attentive to things that I'm saying in this discussion, so you can follow those various threads as you go. But if instead you'd been super certain and written a script and said, Carl, I'm going to say this at this point before I record, I'm going to say this, I want you to say this, I want to do this, nothing that emerges is going to be attentive. It's all predefined, all scripted, all designed to be productive and efficient so that it sounds manicured. But the joy in uncertainty is in paying attention to things, and in paying attention to things, all of these rich paths come up and open up, which I'm sure when you started this conversation today, you had no way of knowing you were going to talk up about an experience you had in 2014 in Kenya.
Yeah. Right?
That's the joy of this uncertainty. That's the joy of paying attention, which when you work with a patient or someone that presents in the clinic, the joy in that uncertainty of what they present with can open up all of these potential paths that you can both go down. That's the stuff I think we, in undergraduate courses, that's the stuff we should be promoting. Maybe the way to do that, as I said at the start, is to encourage people to be hunters of information, discoverers of things, or in our words, wayfinders, figuring ways out as you go, as opposed to transporting ideas on top of a passive world, but working within it, leveraging ways through together.
Oh, Carl, like I'm so appreciative of everything you said. It's funny, this conversation is everything that I wanted it to be for everyone to hear. I went into it with a little bit of uncertainty and unease. So, it's great. And, I think,
That's a really important thing, you know. Like I was uncertain and unsure. I'd never met you.
Yeah.
I didn't know what you wanted to talk through. The big elephant in the room is that's life. Everything is uncertain. You know, we are always figuring it out. We wrote a paper, myself and a colleague, Keith Davids, wrote a paper earlier this year called Sports Scientists in Becoming, you know, from fulfilling our potential to finding our way along. And in sport particularly, this notion of potential fulfillment is rife, you know, like it's like, oh, is this athlete fulfilling their potential? You know, is this you as a runner, you have all this potential. You're not fulfilling it. You're not maximizing it. But that's an incredibly narrow, capacious way of viewing the world, as this like empty vessel to be filled up with all this potential. That's absolutely not what life is about. It's not this certainty, because if that was the case, right, if that was the case, where are you to go if you're a 20-year-old athlete that's won an Olympic gold medal? You've fulfilled your potential. Where to next? You've got 60 to 80 years of your life left. Well, where are you supposed to go then? We shouldn't be viewing life as this certain path of fulfilling your potential, right? Life should just be this ongoing process of just figuring things out as we go along, knowing as we go. And winning a gold medal is just one part of that journey. It's an important part, clearly, but it's not the be-all and end-all. It's just a journey on the way, which adds this really interesting perspective of high-performance sports organizations. You know, like we often think to be a high-performance athlete, you have to dedicate all your life to being a runner or being a swimmer or being a footballer. So you're known as this person, right? You're labeled as being this. That's a really passive, nouned way of viewing people. We're not human beings from that perspective. We're human becomings. So everyone you subsequently meet is always on their way to somewhere, going somewhere else. So a high-performance sporting organization, who's to say we shouldn't foster opportunities for them to follow other interests? You know, like I've just worked with these people in Cirque du Soleil in Canada, and one of their trampolinists has an insanely brilliant capability to take exceptional photographs. So photography is something that's really fascinating for them. And what the organization have done is actively facilitate opportunities for them to pursue that by taking time away from their training to foster opportunities for them to explore photography, right? Brilliant. That's this notion of not trying to say you're a trampolinist. That's all you do. That's what you're defined as. You just need to keep doing that so you can be the best trampolinist you can be and fulfill your potential as this. Yeah, right. That's all. That might be well and good for the 4 or 5 years that I'm able to compete at this level. Where to next? Instead, if we have this view of that they're a human becoming, they're always becoming something else. They're often going into explore these other areas. My job then, as someone that genuinely cares about helping develop opportunities for people to explore their interests and their surrounds in a sporting organization, should be then to foster those opportunities, should be to promote and actively facilitate where I can, as best I can, those opportunities for them to follow up their interests. And that's kind of the play on words in that title, is that, you know, both Keith and myself are trained sports scientists, but what I do these days is not sports science, and what Keith does these days is not sports science, as what a textbook would say it is. To me and to Keith, it feels like sports science, you know, and it sounds a bit like sports science, just not what is conformed to as what being a sports scientist is. I spend a lot of my days these days reading works in social anthropology and ecological psychology and environmental philosophy and ecofeminism and these various domains, and I publish works in those various areas. Now there's no script in sports science that says that's what being a sports scientist is about. Well, absolutely not. I'm just figuring things out as I go. I'm following what interests me. I'm nomadic in that perspective. I don't really have a home as a sports scientist. That's a humbling experience. That's a nerve-wracking experience. That's uncertain in what to do, but it's also incredibly enriching and joyous, because I'm not just a sports scientist from that perspective. Just like the trampolinist isn't just a trampolinist. We're people who live storied lives, always suspended in becoming. They're always on their way to going somewhere else. If you were to ask me 10 years ago, if you were to ask me in 2010, when I went in to do my PhD, I moved from South Australia, went to Western Australia to Edith Cowan University, and said, I'm starting a PhD, Carl. The end of your PhD, what do you want to do? I would have said I wanted to be a high-performance manager in the AFL. By the end of my PhD, I then moved to Townsville to take up a teaching research position in this kind of area, and I loved it. A few years later, I had an opportunity to work as a coaching science innovations manager at Port Adelaide in the AFL, and so I moved back to Adelaide and took on that experience and loved it. Now I live in Melbourne as a research academic who spends their time contemplating what knowing means and what learning is and what education could be and what skill behaviour could be. I have no way of knowing where this is where I was going to end up 10 years ago, let alone a year ago. Like, I don't know. I'm just following things that are interesting to me and reading things and talking with people like yourself and figuring things out as I go. There is no end in that journey, right? There's no point of which I go, that's it. I'm now an accomplished sports scientist. That's it. I don't need to do it. Absolutely not. Not only is that arrogant, but it's also really boring for me. Like, I'm like, well, who wants to do that? You know, I don't want to be labeled as just that. No, if anything, you know, you want to be labeled in a way as like a, you know, a homeless scholar that's always figuring things out. It's always on the move. I'm not a noun from that perspective. I'm a verb. I'm doing things all the time because I'm interested in various things. I think that's the important thing to consider in these situations. It's not a matter of labeling. Expertise isn't a matter of labeling and fulfilling and reaching these destinations that we plan out for years in advance. No. This is the big myth with it all that we seem to forget in this overly productified society. We're all figuring it out as we go. We're all trying to work things out as we go and talk with people and work towards knowing things that interest us better than before. So don't shy away from that. Embrace that. Take up with it. Embrace that uncertainty. Embrace that humility. Because that's where the real fun stuff can happen. Again, you're never more attentive than when you feel like you're a little bit lost.
Yeah.
In part of your life. That's what we need to hang on to, that meta stability, I think.
That's beautiful, Carl. I'm wary of your time and I'm so thankful for all the wisdom and information that you've shared with listeners. There'll be a lot of runners probably listening to this. On their runs or just when they get a chance to, they won't be attuned to their current environment, but they'll be attuned to your words and that'll open up possibilities down the track. And just so much of it, especially that end bit there, I've got a kid who I coach who, he's all in on running and then it was at the expense of a lot of aspects of his life. And he thought that if he was just super serious with running, he'd go better. But then in a lot of parts of his life, I don't think he was the happiest he could have been or the most wholesome and balanced he could be. And, so really explored it, trying to test him in other areas of his life. And his running actually has improved as a result, which is really funny. He's actually become less focused on the running, but his running's going better, which is an interesting fallout to all that. But then also he's preparing for life, after say competitive running, where he'll probably always run, but you're not always going to be at the level that he currently at.
It's you know, it's funny, we live in a society that loves to fragment, you know, that go, you know, even this notion that, you know, I work at work and at home I'm a different person, you know, I have a work identity, I have a home identity, you know, or at the gym I just do my exercise and then when I'm at home, never. So we like to fragment and keep things split, right? And like to categorize things into places, like thinking like it's all a big jigsaw puzzle and it's all put together. I like to think the complete other end of the spectrum. I like to blur everything. I like to mess everything up. I like to join everything as best I can. I don't like boundaries between work and home. Now, I appreciate that's not for everybody. That's perfectly fine. For me, though, I love what I do, right? I love the work that I do. For me, it's never felt like a profession. It's just a hobby, you know? It's an amateurism in every sense of the word, you know, amateur, the etymology meaning to love, right? So, but I also love going for a run. I also love skateboarding. I also love diving and fishing and spearfishing. I also love spending time with my partner, Chloe, and going to the coffee shop. And I also love reading, and I also love watching sport. And I also love hanging out with my nieces and nephews and my parents and Chloe's family. I love all of these other parts. I shouldn't feel like I have to fragment those things. They should all be complementary, right? So they should all come together. So hopefully then when you read our work, you see parts of my life that are like a bit, people go, oh, I didn't know you could write scientifically about, you know, playing in the garden as a kid with your sister, or I didn't know that you could write scientifically about, you know, attending a communal garden when you were younger and how that's had marketable impacts on your life, or all of these rich things. Of course you can. Of course you can, because everything should be enriching. By default, those experiences enrich my academic work. My academic work, by default, enriches all these other parts of my life. So it's not fragmented. I shouldn't be like, I'm not an academic between 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, and then, you know, a skateboarder on Saturday morning, and then, you know, a coffee drinker on Sunday afternoon. I'm just Carl, figuring things out as I go, and all of these things are enriching and come together. So in your case, it shouldn't be a surprise that by blending all of these things together for this young person that you train, should all be enriching by finding time to explore these other things that are of interest, should foster an interest in running, should bleed into running, it should bleed into these other parts of their lives. It shouldn't be something that we actively try to split away from one another, in my perspective at least. And I appreciate that not everyone loves the work that they do and loves the jobs that they undertake, but where possible, I think we should be bringing these things together and enriching our lives. It's not a fragmentation of things. It's a coming together, and science is a shocker for that, right? So physiotherapists look at a patient as a physiotherapist, and then a biomechanist will look at them as a biomechanist, and a podiatrist will look at them as a podiatrist. It's not to say that one perspective is right or wrong. They're just all unique perspectives. What I think we should be pushing towards is this much more transdisciplinary, blended approach to inquiry, where the patient is just providing another perspective. They are an expert on themselves, right? So we have to, or we should be listening to them. You are an expert in physiotherapy, so we should listen to you, but we should also listen to the podiatrist and the parent and all of these. We should listen to all this information, and it's all blurred. We shouldn't split it apart and fragment it like one discipline is better than another or has a more knowledgeability than another discipline. Blend it all together in one particular plate, this transdisciplinary way of doing science and undertaking inquiry is much more holistic and enriching, I think, for all parties. And you're more inclined to pay attention to things and learn new things and figure things out. As some of the most profound lessons I've ever learned when I worked in high performance sport was from the athletes themselves. It wasn't from coaches, wasn't from other academics or scientists, or it was from the athletes. It was like, you did something funny there. Why did you do that? Oh, because this and this. And I'm like, oh geez, I didn't even see that or hear that or feel that, or, you know, this is this rich information that comes from being humble and open and not trying to fragment. You're a player, I'm a scientist, you do what I say because I know more than you. Absolutely not. It should just be a big mixing pot of all this rich information, and through that, ways forward kind of fall out, I think.
And you feel like the fact that the Western world, like so much of it is, we like have to produce and be efficient, and then we lose that because we're so time conscious. Like we're like, oh, quick, we've got to do this and this. Then we're missing those they just go by, those opportunities or those chances.
Definitely, yeah, definitely. I mean, and the educational institutions are set up in that efficient way. You know, like you often think we split an undergraduate degree, right? Let's just take a sports science degree up into these various subdisciplines because it's easier to teach in those ways. And then it's almost left to the students to kind of try to piece these things together themselves, or not see the similarities between things, not go, oh, in biomechanics they talk about it as this, but in, you know, physiology they talk about it as this, or in skill act they talk about it in this, in sports psych they talk, they're kind of left to either fragment and push away or slowly, clunkily try to piece these things together. Instead, maybe if we placed a theme or a case at the center of our educational experiences, things would open up much more differently, because you work out very fast that no problem is ever broached purely as a physiotherapy problem or a podiatry problem. It's entangled in an environment that people live in, right? And it might manifest in the footwear that they wear, or it might manifest in the way they move, or which are looked at through these various subdisciplinary lenses, but it's much more blurred and much more messy and much more entangled in these things. For that exact reason, that's why exercise promotion is always a real challenge in our current society. We talk much more in a metric and productive sense of get your 10,000 steps in, eat your three veg and two fruit, you know. They clearly don't work. Those metric, outcome-focused, productified views of physical activity do not work. And we know they don't work because health-related issues are going up, right? So what we need to do is change our scale of analysis. Stop viewing people as commodities to get steps or machines to eat fruit and vegetable. And start working out why. Why do we need to advocate for 10,000 steps? Why do we need to advocate for fruit and vegetable? There are bigger systemic issues embedded in our environment for this to happen. So for argument's sake, maybe we need to foster more green spaces in local surrounds. And maybe within those green spaces, we could plant communal fruit and vegetable trees. Right? So all of a sudden, people are engaging in physical activity in spaces conducive for health benefits, which we know through some really fascinating research in time in green spaces, but they're also caring about fruit trees, and children are becoming eco-literate through being able to read their surrounds by spending time in it. So all of a sudden, the 10,000 steps disappears and falls away because they're accumulating this additionary physical activity through being immersed in tasks that come to matter to them. And this is all around redesigning spaces to afford rich opportunities for exploration. There's a brilliant example of this in Footscray under Hopkins Bridge. Any listeners might be familiar with it. There's a communal rock climbing, a bouldering wall that's been installed there, prior to which it was an uninviting place, nothing there, maybe even a place that people actively avoided at certain times of the day. Redesigning this particular place to become a place of exploration and moving in different ways and discovering things for themselves all of a sudden becomes a hive of activity, and people are drawn in, and they start as in this peripheral involvement, maybe standing on the side and just watching, and then slowly giving something a go. And through this ongoing involvement, all of a sudden they become an implicated participant in that particular part of their surround. They're not viewing it as, I have to climb to get my movement goal done every day, or I have to do this to get my 10,000 steps. They're doing it because they care about that particular feature. They want to become a participant in that communal behavior. And all of a sudden, health benefits become paramount. Health benefits incur, but it's not because they're prioritizing the outcome. It's just a byproduct of participating within their surrounds. So this is where, you know, urban designers, ecological psychologists, human movement scientists, local advocacy groups, state governments, all of these people can come together and start to redesign parts of our surrounds to be more inviting for certain behavior, becomes much more blended and transdisciplinary, and we start to approach these issues of inactivity and these things from a much more environmentally scaled person in place, as opposed to it being like you need to get your 10,000 steps in. Great. I live in Port Melbourne. There's a beautiful boardwalk at the end of where I live. But this time of year, it becomes pretty uninviting after work for lots of people because it's really poorly lit. So why would you want to go running along there at nighttime after work, particularly now with daylight savings disappearing? A simple redesign of that feature makes that uninviting place all of a sudden much more inviting for exploration and interaction for people to promote physical activity. So really, really subtle things, but really carefully scaled things, I think can have really large impacts on you know, societal behavior at a much more global scale, instead of saying to people, you know, you got to do this. You got to get your 10,000 steps in, or you like take you and I and maybe listeners. We're probably all pretty motivated runners, right? So even on a pretty crappy day, we're probably still going to go for a run. The most dangerous thing I think we can do is to then take that lens and impose it upon other people. We go, just go for a run. Just do it. You know, why don't you just go for a run? Like, I'm going for a run. Come with me. Just do it. That's a shocking way of trying to promote behavioral change. And instead, what we should be doing is, why don't you want to go for a run? How can we redesign features of that surround to become more inviting for physical activity, for engagement, for exploration, and all those other things will fall away because people partake in behavior that is interesting for them first and foremost because it's a task that they want to do, not because they're having to go, I have to get my 10,000 steps in, so I'm just going to walk around my house or walk around my garden. No. They're walking around their garden because they're attending to fruit trees, or they're walking in these green spaces because they've been redesigned to with more shade, so there's more opportunity to walk on a sunny day. I'm rambling a little bit, but there's a great example of that. I when I was living in North Queensland, I had a school come to our research group, a local school come to our research group and say, we want to know why our students are physically inactive at recess and lunch. They're not doing anything. We're just about to invest quite heavily in redesigning the play equipment, right? So, but before we do that, we just want to know what they're doing at recess and lunch anyway. So what we did over the course of a 6-month period is we stuck GPS units on the kids and just tracked their inhabitation tendencies in the playgrounds. And what we found really fascinatingly was that the kids were congregating in shaded areas. Why? North Queensland is bloody hot, right? Like in summer, there's a lot of sun. It's an uncomfortable place to be. From that finding, we suggested back to the school, before you invest in all this play equipment and redesigning of apparatus and this stuff, just plant some more shaded trees and stick up some more shade cloths and let's see how that changes. Almost overnight, children's exploratory behaviour changed, and we kept the GPS units on them for another 6-month period, and we saw their behaviour drastically change through the simple redesign and addition of shade in their local surrounds. So sometimes these big shifts in behaviour can happen in the most subtle of ways, but we have to, I think, first and foremost, pay attention to them and pay attention to them at the scale of an individual in an environment, not an individual detached or separate from an environment, but an individual embedded in a particular context.
Yeah, fantastic. And like that sort of, I want to wrap it up because you've been too generous with your time. I think that's a great place to wrap it up, and like so much information for everyone to, you know, think about and take home and use how they feel like it's relevant to them. I was thinking about how this related to the last 2 years. I was working at in a physio business for 11 years, and then the last 2 years since COVID, I've worked by myself. And one of the huge benefits is that I've been able to see patients for a little bit longer. I was getting really burnt out with the half an hour sort of appointments, and I was sort of stuck in this one little room for 11 years, and I just treated the same way all the time. I wasn't really exposed to any other ways of practicing. And the last 2 years, I've been able to do more coaching. I've been able to get outside. I've been a bit more open and learnt about concepts that you talk about that others in the ecological dynamics sort of field talk about, and it's made me sort of appreciate, sort of get out of my physio silo and appreciate sort of the whole human and everything that goes into it a lot better. And it's been super empowering as a physio, and you feel like you're doing a better job because of it.
It's more enriching for you as a person, right? Like that's always the weird paradox as well. We often talk about impact and people doing their jobs, and you as a physio have to impact your clients' lives and stuff. Impact can have a meaningful shift on you as well, right? You are part of that ecology of relation, right? You are an integral part of that. So impact can also have a frame of reference to the person that's doing these things. That's why I said at the start, you know, I write for myself. If one person reads my paper or 1,000 people read it, it's had a meaningful shift on me as a person. And who's to say that's any less impactful than it having been read by 1,000 people? You know, you changing your practice, where you practice, opens up new opportunities for you. It's been impactful for you, which inadvertently bleeds into how you work with people and how you take up with people. Even the sheer notion of, you don't look at a person as, I've got Carl coming in from 10:30, 11. You look at Carl as, I can't do that. I've got a 10:30, 11 an appointment, right? Instead, if you have this view of, no, I'm seeing Carl today, and that might be half an hour, it might be 45 minutes, it might be 10 minutes, it might be an hour, it might lead into a half an hour catch up because I do have something else at 11 o'clock, but I'm going to give you a buzz back later, and we're going to explore this a little bit more. It becomes more enriching and impactful for you, which becomes more enriching and impactful for the people that you work with, because you start to take up at a much more relational or relatable level, and you start to view them as people who also live lives in becoming and live lives in places that have all these rich and diverse affordances for action, these opportunities for action, which have a huge impact on you. But that's fascinating. I think that's something that listeners could almost do straight away. We get so absorbed in doing same things in routines, parking our car in the same spot, walking to the same coffee shop, running the same route, change up subtle things, park somewhere different, run a slightly different route, run at a different time of the day, go to a different coffee shop, because what that does is it opens up new affordances in the landscape, which you can start to attend to, which inadvertently has a meaningful shift on you as well. So yeah, that's a nice story to hear of you perturbing your behavior through changing your surrounds.
I knew I needed to do it, but it took a few years to go through with it. Thanks so much, Carl, and a fantastic chat. And I just know that a lot of people will benefit a lot from this, or it'll spark some curiosity at least. So I hope that's fulfilling for you.
Not at all. And as I said, I love opportunities to talk to people like yourself and hear how these ideas resonate and learn new things as I go as well, and figure out how people are responsive or perhaps not as responsive to certain ideas. But it's super enriching for me talking to people like you. So no, thanks for the opportunity to jump on and talk shop for a bit.
Thanks, Carl. I'll wrap it up there.